Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so thankful that you took the time to download us and you're listening today. We have a special edition today. We have, as always, interesting people from the world of sports medicine and human performance with us, and today is certainly no exception. We have Mr. Mike Caruso with us. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thank you.
And let me tell everybody a little bit about you. Mike is our current Associate Athletic Director for Events and Game Operations here at Texas A&M. He's been with the athletic department for over 20 years. One of the important reasons that we have a Mike on today is that he directs all 21 of the Aggies sports and event management and game operations, including any kind of NCAA regional or national championship events we have here. He's been heavily involved with the National Center for Spectator Sports Safety and Security since 2008 with curriculum development and instructing at national training workshops. And he's a trainer for the TEKS, National Emergency Response and Rescue Training Center, in their sports and special events incident management workshops. And given the events of this past week, we thought we'd have Mike on to talk a little bit about what we do, and I'm sure what's kind of common across the country. And one other thing before we go on, you can tell that Mike is very good at what he does, because in 2011 we were given the Sport Event Security Aware Award, and then that was followed by the NCAA Facility of the Year Award, both of which Mike was heavily involved with and probably responsible for. So again, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's one way it's sad that we have to have an event like Boston happen before we get you on the podcast.
Yeah.
But I think it's very relevant to talk about these kind of things. Speak to us from an event management. While you can't plan for everything, you do have plans for if something happens.
Right. They had a plan in place. They had an incident action plan, which we all have, or we should all have, but hopefully they don't ever get to use it. You have your event action plan, which is your standard operating procedures, how things should happen under normal flow for your event. And this speaks directly towards the course that TEKS is teaching. It's a sport and a special event management course. We teach not just, and it initially started with the NCS4, National Center for Spectator Sports Safety and Security, where we were focusing on stadiums and large events, large gatherings of people. And we have broadened that to where now it's special events. When the last workshop that I went to and trained at, we had representatives from the San Francisco Giants and 49ers, as well as concert folks from the city of San Francisco and the Beta Breakers race, which is very similar to what is going on. But all those people came with the same pattern of having an event where they're going to have a large collection of individuals. They're going to have different parameters for their event, but they all wanted to do the training so that they had a plan in place and an incident plan in place if something does go wrong. And obviously, in the case of the Boston Marathon, they had to utilize their incident command and as well as their protection for the spectators as well as the race participants.
What kind of thing goes into one of those plans? I mean, do people sit around the table and go, "Oh man, this might happen. What will we do if that happens?"
Actually, that's exactly what happens. Is first thing you do is a risk analysis. You look at what are the most common things that might go wrong in this event. Obviously, for us and for the outdoor sports, weather is a key factor, and that's really true across the country. But again, it's different across the country. Again, going back to that that workshop I was working at in California, you know, you talk about what's common risks and common hazards, and for them, tsunami is an obvious something, an event that they have to plan for. Not real high on my risk.
If we have a tsunami in Texas A&M, we're really in trouble, aren't
right.
we?
but the first thing you do is you do a risk assessment, and you look at it from an all hazards approach. You look at it from man-made potential as well as natural potential. What is most likely to happen during an event, and you put a plan in place to manage an incident if it would occur, given those variables. So the first thing you do is a risk analysis, and I'm sure, you know, besides weather, they're looking for things typically on the radar for them would be heat-related incidents, you know, hydration issues, and things of that nature. But in this case, and in our case for events here too, you have a plan in place for something like this, an explosive device or a man-made disaster.
I was going to ask, so terrorism is a real risk that's discussed in these kind of situations.
Oh, absolutely. We do tabletop exercises annually where we'll bring in, we do it for football primarily, but we'll bring in everybody who's in our command center, which is across the board. I mean, we have, if you look at an event that has 87,000 people come to it, there is no university in the world that can have all the resources necessary to be able to, first of all, manage that event on a regular basis, but then also if there is an incident that would occur, if there is something that happens that is out of the ordinary, the resources that are needed to respond to that and react to that, there's no university has those. We have in our command center at Kyle Field, we have law enforcement from both cities, from the county, the sheriff's there, the DHS is there. We have FBI folks, Joint Terrorism Task Force, so up in the federal level, all those people get together and come in to do an exercise. And basically what we do is we say, well, what are the things that are most likely to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, weather events we can respond to, and we can do that internally. But we have done, for example, we have done a hazmat issue. We have done a train derailment issue. We have done a number of different things where what would we do if? And this is the what if. Response to something that you hope never happens.
Right. Do you lay awake at night? awake at night worrying about these? Like if we had a tornado touchdown during one of the football games.
You know, yes. I don't lay awake at night, but I'm concerned. But the good part about it is I take comfort in the fact that I know that we have a plan. We have a plan in place to deal with the normal activities and the smaller and minor things that may happen inside of a large gathering of people like a football game. But then we also have a plan in place, and we have people in place. We have resources in place to be able to respond. First thing we want to do is try and prevent. Obviously, that's number one out of the gate. If we can't prevent it, we need to be able to respond to it and recover from it. So that's the scenario that we go through in our planning, and we really have it. I have it extremely probably the best that I could from any university. I go around and teach these workshops at just different universities. Level of cooperation that we have, the collaboration that we have from all those agencies I talked about is just tremendous. They come in and they are a tremendous support, not just for our normal, normal game day, but also then from the standpoint if we did have an incident. Ours is truly over the top. I go to other places around the country where they really fight and struggle to try and get that collaboration from different agencies, but they need those agencies because those agencies have the resources that are ready to respond to an incident.
Well, that was, and what you just said, that reminded me of some of the criticisms after 9/11 was the lack of collaboration amongst some of the different units, and so it's great to hear that that's happening here very well, and that's people are trying to make that happen in other places as well.
There's a unity of command, and where we do have a incident commander, and you know that incident up in West probably typifies that. You had so many different entities that were coming in trying to help. If you just let them work on their own, it would be total chaos.
Right.
You have a unity of command, which is there's an incident commander. He is the person that is giving, he or she is giving the instructions on what to do and where to apply the resources. And then you have a unified command, which is basically everybody that bring somebody like College Station Fire brings their people. They still control their people and give orders to their people, but the person who is giving the orders to their people, say for College Station Fire, is getting it from the unity of command, the incident commander.
Yeah, and before I guess we go on, we were talking before we went on the recording here about what was going on in West, and you made a statement that was intriguing to me, and that was that you could tell they had a plan.
Yeah, you could. I mean, there were people in waiting, there were people in position, and it didn't look like an anthill where people were going all different directions. It was orderly, it was organized, which told me that they did have a incident commander there that was in charge and getting all the resources coordinated.
Do you, when you put these plans together, do you plan differently when you have an event where you have 90,000 people around one event versus a Boston Marathon where you've got people dispersed over a 26-mile course?
Absolutely. You have different sets of variables, and and not only from the standpoint of difference in the event, but the size and scope and nature of the event. Mm-hmm. I mean, depending on who the rivalry is, depending on what the event is, we have, I'll say the exact same plan, but obviously it's going to have different variables. But we have a plan for men's and women's tennis, you know, where we may have 300-400 spectators. But, you know, if my daughter or your son goes to that tennis event, you want them to be safe. You want them to come home just like the 87,000 that come to football. So we do the same planning. It's obviously at a different scale and a different scope than it would be for, you know, a major, and different variables, different resources.
So one of the things we ask people here, tell us a little bit how they got interested in this. I mean, what happened? Was there something in your life that provoked you to become involved in emergency management training, or is this something you just woke up one day and said, well, this is what I'm going to do?
It was really something I inherited. My background is basketball. I was a basketball player at Creighton University. I was a basketball coach for the first 14 years of my post graduate work, and then I got involved in event management at a Division III school. Really enjoyed it. Got the opportunity to expand it here at Texas A&M, and I've kind of grown with the program here. Back when I first got here, there was no such thing as a command center. I mean, at football, when I first got here, there was one person in the game manager's booth who basically handled custodial and you know, maintenance
plumbing
situation.
We have a restroom that's plugged up.
and the command center was the chief of police with two other policemen and a emergency, an EMS person also, though. There's four of them who just sat there, were watching a game, and if there was, you know, something happened, they'd call on the radio and take care of it. Post 9/11, obviously things have changed. Our preparedness and our readiness needed to change, and so all of us have grown in it, and some are still catching up, to be honest with you. You know, it's again the collaboration and the amount of resources that you have available to be able to respond to something is obviously going to lessen the effects and lessen the impact down the road on your institution in this case. So, you know, everyone is, I think, beginning to realize incidents like this, like at the Boston Marathon, incidents where things happen inside of larger athletic events kind of get everybody's radar up. And then also incidents on campuses, you know, unrelated to sports, have also gotten campuses involved more in the emergency management issues. And it's the same, it's kind of the same continuous improvement cycle where your plan, you develop a plan, you test that plan, or someone tests it for you. And then out of that, you get your results, your after action, your follow up, what did we do right, what did we do wrong, and then how can we improve it? So you continuously improve. We do it in the event management field. We do it in our standard operations and our procedures. We have follow-ups after every game on what went well, what part of our facility or of our management or game management went well, and we focused and continue to do those. But the things that we find where we didn't do so well, that's improvement for the next game.
So episodes like the recent bomb threats that we've had here at A&M that have caused – evacuation of the campus, and other universities have had this. We're not alone in that. Those things actually do add into the knowledge that is brought into these kind of plans.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also makes you aware of the resources needed. And you know, basically what you're doing is you're looking at, again, you do that risk analysis, you do take an all-hazards approach, man-made and natural, and you look at what's most likely to happen. What's the most likely hazard to influence? All right, now, if that happens, if it does, who are we going to call? What do we need to be able to respond to it and, you know, recover from it? And so those are the people then that you start to invite in on the planning portion of it, so that they're involved in your plan. They take ownership in that plan, and so they're going to come and help you. And that's really where I think we are head and shoulders above a lot of other institutions in the level of collaboration that we have and cooperation we have from all those outside agencies that bring resources here for our large events on campus for sporting events, but also other events.
In recovering, you used the word recover a while ago, an event has happened. You're trying to evacuate people. What's the biggest thing you have to be concerned about with evacuation? I know with one of the bomb threats, it was you couldn't get off campus. You couldn't drive your car off campus. I mean, they kept saying walk off campus because you're not going to be able to drive off campus.
Well, evacuation, in fact, that's the next workshops that we're developing right now that are in the developmental stage, and I just finished testing and a curriculum development for it is evacuation. It is probably the one thing that we all talk about. We plan for it. We hope we absolutely never have to do it because that's if you get into an evacuation situation, you are really putting yourself at a higher level of risk for all the people that are involved. It's a very difficult thing to do. We have, you know, but we practice evacuation and we record evacuation. We have been for the last 2 years. We record at Texas A&M football how long it takes for our stands to empty. We're unique in the standpoint that most of our fans stay to the end of the game, so it's a little easier for us. But I know exactly how long it takes for us to clear the portals on the east side of our stadium and on the west side of our stadium.
Can you tell us those things?
Sure. It's 13 and a half minutes on the east side and a little bit longer on the west side. Our folks on the west side are a little more aged and you know, it takes them a little longer to get away. Plus, a lot of them want to use the elevators, which we wouldn't be able to in evacuation. But so that tells me, as a minute planner, I've got a 15-minute window. If I say we're going to leave and we have to leave, you know, through the incident commander, obviously, also, we know we need 15 minutes of lead time. We can't make that decision and say, okay, we got to have everybody out here in 5 minutes. Not going to happen, right. So that's all part of the planning portion of it. But evacuations is just a whole other set of variables. You have to know where you're evacuating to. You need to have people that are there. First of all, if it's the MSC or if it's Duncan Hall, wherever, you need people ahead of the evacuee. So that 15 minutes that it takes for us to leave, we also need to give our people in to get into position to execute the evacuation. We need to give them additional time to be in place for the evacuation. Evacuations are just a real difficult situation that we always hope that we never have to be involved in. Yeah,
Our university here, and one of the things we're thinking about is that we are rebuilding our stadium, our football stadium. Mm-hmm. When they start to do a big project like that, do they come to folks like you and say, hey, we're about to redo this, we need to talk about evacuation routes or how quickly it does? I mean, are y'all part of that planning for those kind of big buildings? And I'm thinking about, you know, the number of stadiums around the country that are built like that.
Yeah, they had a meeting with Environmental Health and Safety, University Police, as well as Event Management. We all gave our input. We said, like, here is our wish list. Here's our dream list. We want to have, you know, all these different things in place. Then they take it forward, look at the standards that are for new buildings, across the country and really around the world, and they try and develop and incorporate as much of that in as possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but all of your planning is based upon what you have. What is your facility like? What is your workforce like? What is your crowd like? What is your inside of your facility like? So, you know, you take all that in consideration whenever you're making your planning. So we're going to start new and different planning. Our command center moves because it where it is now. They have access to be able to see in the stadium. They're not going to be because we're going to close the stadium. So we had to plan for a new place for the command center. And actually, we're going to improve it with the new facility because we're going to have a better structure in place down in the place where the command center is, which is pretty much in the bowels of the stadium underneath it. But we're also putting some of the eyes that have never been able to be able to see visually inside of the bowl of the stadium. We're going to put them in a position where they're going to be able to do that. So we're taking this opportunity to make things better.
Well, that's the thing people don't remember or don't think about when you renovate or build a new stadium. You have to put all that infrastructure in place, and that's stuff people will never see.
Well, and the way that the stadium is going, it's probably a lot akin to the design for the Bluebell Park, our new baseball stadium. We're going to have a lot more premium seating all around the stadium, but primarily in the west side, which means that my workforce will probably triple on the inside. Currently, there's about 2,000 people that work for me at a home football game. We're going to probably double that with the new stadium. So we're going to be looking for employees real quick.
That's a big workforce.
Yeah. Well, Cowboy Stadium is upwards of 6,000. But again, and the reason that they have so many is because they have so many special access places. Every door where it's a club or a suite or some, you know, private access, and when there's alcohol involved, you need to have somebody at every entrance and exit. So,
wow.
Yeah.
It gets big pretty quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. But, boy, is it going to be nice.
Yeah. So how do you communicate with a crowd of 80,000 if there's an event that happens and you've got to get them out?
Yeah. There's a number of different communication pieces. In fact, communication is probably one of the key components. In fact, when I go around to different places, I tell them that if you're going to test anything on an annual basis, test your communication piece. We have a very elaborate communication tree where from the incident commander, all the different branches come down for whether it's medical, fire, police, event operations, and maintenance folks, and mm-hmm. custodial. Everybody that has a radio, everybody that has a piece involved in the communication portion of it is trained to know who they're going to get information from, who they're going to get information from, and then what they do with it and how they react to it. But it's a very elaborate communication tree, but it's very simple from the standpoint of I know as an usher I'm going to hear from my supervisor. My supervisor knows he's going to hear from event manager. Event manager knows he's going to hear. So it's a descending communication tree that gets one message, so it comes from one source, so everybody hears it. But that's something that we do annually, too, when we have that tabletop exercise. When we get everybody back here in the summer, we'll set up the command center just to test it, make sure all these pieces work. But then we'll do our tabletop exercise. But the one thing that we test every year is a communication piece.
I want us to kind of close with the thought you keep coming back to that you said is that we hope we never have to use these things, and mm-hmm. we all do. Reminds me of early in my career, I was asking for money to buy a crash cart for our lab mm-hmm. in case we had a heart attack or whatever, and I had an administrator said, well, you won't ever use that, so we're not going to buy one. Mm-hmm. And it was like, sometimes you got to put things in place, even if hopefully you'll never use them.
Well, and, again, case in point, you look at Boston Marathon.
Right.
They're saying, we've never had any trouble, so we don't need a plan, or we don't need this, that, or the other. Well, then it comes and it happens. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that's the hardest part about it is the what if, and are you prepared for it?
Mm-hmm.
And, again, the thing that allows me to sleep at night, that doesn't keep me up at night, is I know that we've got a great group of individuals as well as entities that are going to come and help us, and then we have a plan in place to be able to respond to anything. So I know that we're going to do the very best job that we can to respond to anything, and again, that's going to allow us, the recovery is going to be much shorter and going to be a lot less impact on us.
You have a bit of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, you got good people that are working with you and helping you, and you've got a good plan in place, so you feel comfortable with the fact that you're going to be able to take on anything that happens.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you today.
Thank you
so much. We always leave with a take-home message. So do you have a take-home message for the audience?
Well, I would just encourage everyone, and I think this is being addressed here in the Boston incident that happened, is for people to be aware. We have something with our event staff that is see something, say something, and we talk to them about it. If you see something that is not right, talk to somebody about it. Bring it up to your supervisor, bring it up to law enforcement. I'd say the same thing for fans in a large experience like this. If you see something that you look at and say, well, that's not quite right, is that the way it should be? Bring it up to somebody, let them look at it, take it to the next level, and let them decide. Because we need their help just as much as they want to enjoy that fan experience just like we want them to.
Yeah, and most stadiums now have some number that you can call, right, or some way that you can notify.
Yeah, we have a text message system at Kyle Field where you can, anything out of the ordinary from, your seat's broken to somebody's loud and obnoxious around me to, hey, I saw something that I'm not sure you may want to check out. So it's an anonymous text messaging system that they can alert the game manager as well as the incident commander.
Loud and obnoxious, though, we shouldn't report visiting fans, should we?
No, that happens a lot.
No,
we try and discourage them from saying, how come coach is running so much? We don't want that kind of message.
Okay. Mike, thank you again for taking time on such short notice to come over and speak with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We've enjoyed it. And thank you all for taking the time to download us this week. And as always, we have a podcast question of the week brought to us right now by Kelly.
What is the first step emergency planners take in developing response for special event incidents?
Excellent question. So be the first one to send us the correct answer for that at huffinespodcast@hokn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. And again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and be with us this week. We hope you'll join us next week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine, human performance. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Larick and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.